Welcome to Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by NeoGenomics, we had the pleasure of speaking with Sherry Brown, MD, Director of Molecular Pathology Services at NeoGenomics, and Hatim Hussein, MD, an Associate Professor of Medicine at UC San Diego Health, to discuss the current role of next-generation sequencing in lung cancer. In our exclusive interview, Brown and Hussein discuss the current and future applications of next-generation sequencing in lung cancer, the role of tissue-based testing in light of the growing role for liquid-based testing, and some of the emerging technologies that could overcome current barriers to biomarker testing. Dr. Brown, could you kind of set the stage for us and broadly speak to the current role of next-generation sequencing in lung cancer? What is the clinical need for this sort of testing?
This is a topic that comes up often among clinicians when they want to order the guideline recommended biomarkers for lung cancer. There are certain ones that we know are going to change treatment of prognostic significance, and some also resistance mutations that might indicate that we need to switch medication in a patient that's progressing on a specific drug. The difference between next generation sequencing and a lot of single gene tests that we could perform is that next generation sequencing with a small specimen of tissue has the ability to test, you know, its name is massively parallel next generation sequencing. It's the ability to test multiple genes in one test. And it also has increased sensitivity compared to a lot of other tests like Sanger testing, which is done for a couple of different types of biomarkers. And it's also, you know, the ability to detect things that are not anticipated. So if what we think is, you know, we're just looking for a BRAF V600, we might be able to order a PCR test, but next generation sequencing will also be able to detect the BRAF, you know, 596, 594, you know, some of the other mutations that maybe perhaps were not expected other than the most common alteration or hotspot in a specific gene. So this ability to detect more mutations with a smaller piece of tissue is the best benefit that it offers and increased sensitivity over some of the other tests, but also the ability to test both DNA and RNA with the same specimen. So for RNA tests, we can detect the fusions or gene rearrangements, which are significant in lung cancer, like ALK and ROS, and also additionally things like MET exon 14 deletion or skipping, and other types of mutations such as this. And with next generation sequencing, particularly if the lab is using a type of extraction to get the both DNA and RNA out of the same piece of tissue, there's a smaller piece of tissue that can be used. Also, we have the ability to do plasma circulating tumor DNA or cell, what we call cell-free DNA in the blood. And also all of these things that we can detect with the tissue, we can also detect in plasma. So in regards to the clinical need for this sort of testing, it's really the only way to ensure with one test or a smaller number of tests that you're getting all of the biomarkers that are recommended right now for managing a lung cancer patient, as well as additional biomarkers, what we call emerging biomarkers, for which a patient could qualify for many alternate treatments or clinical trials. And we know the more patients that we can get on clinical trial, it increases their survival as well as increases our medical knowledge and helps us get new drugs that are effective approved in a faster way.
Now, Dr. Hussein, lung cancer has really become the so-called poster child for targeted therapy. What are the key biomarkers you're really looking out for when utilizing NGS? And what are some of the key emerging biomarkers on the horizon?
Well, thank you so much for that question. It's a really appropriate question because in recent years, we've seen truly an explosion in the number of approved therapies across a number of different targets, with the most recent being KRAS G12C that was approved this year. Some of the notable other approvals historically have been EGFR mutations, ALK fusions, ROS1 fusions, MET exon 14 skip mutations, BRAF V600E mutations, NTRK fusions, RET fusions, and we have a number of different targets on the horizon. Most notably, HER2 mutations in lung cancer, for which clinical trials are ongoing. I think what's really important is there's more emerging information about how concomitants of mutations together can also influence outcomes. And so further analyses will look at how the association of genes can also provide some important clues into which patients may derive the best benefit to certain therapies.
Dr. Brown, regarding minimal residual disease, how do you foresee this playing a role in lung cancer going forward?
So previously, we've been able to use a variety of molecular techniques for minimal residual disease in the hematologic malignancies, but we've been a little bit slower to bring it to the clinical setting for lung cancer. However, with the increased use of liquid biopsy as surveillance, therapeutic monitoring after surgery, and things like that, we really see an increased use of this NGS technology in the MR, looking for minimal residual disease for lung cancer patients. Also, an opportunity. So let's say, for an example, we have a patient with a well-circumscribed lung cancer that is surgically excised. Maybe there was one or two lymph nodes involved and a patient would get a systemic therapy and seems to be doing fine. But 1 to 2 years later, how do we know that this patient doesn't have residual disease? And often, if we don't have a method like liquid biopsy to monitor, we don't know until it's too late, until they have a lump in the neck, in a lymph node, a cervical lymph node, or maybe they're coughing up blood or bone pain in the spine, and we find it on PET scan. And so those ways, that's not the ideal way to find out when it's too late. The ideal way is, to kind of find out earlier and earlier. And so that's been our goal in medicine, is to find ways where we can detect recurrence, and also, how we treat minimal residual disease and how we approach that from a technical perspective of being able to detect mutations at a very low level in the blood. That's also has, we're able to transfer that to detecting early detection of disease in patients that don't have a diagnosis. So all of those things are an opportunity. We have the ability to use those types of approaches to help many different types of patients, but particularly to be able to follow patients in the therapeutic setting for lung cancer. I see that being used more and more, and I expect it to double in quadruple in probably the next year to 2 years.
Dr. Hussain, could you speak to the role of tissue-based testing in the context of the growing role for liquid-based testing?
I think it's truly important to highlight that tissue is still the gold standard. Whenever available, it is important to have the tissue analyzed, largely because there can be a false negative rate with liquid biopsy. If a ctDNA test is negative, one should really do the diligence to make sure that that tissue has been adequately assayed. And because of the ease of liquid biopsy, sometimes we fail to remember that the tissue is a source that can still be assayed. So I do think actually that tissue is still the gold standard. It has a good sensitivity for copy number gain and fusion events. Liquid biopsy is an important additional tool. And specifically when tissue is not available, some of the other added advantages of a liquid biopsy is the turnaround time. And that can be helpful when it's positive, as we can help to select those patients sooner who may derive benefit from targeted therapies. Also importantly, liquid biopsy can give us information about a diversity of different metastatic targets. Presumably, those metastatic targets may shed into the blood, and that may have some advantages rather than a one spatial point of a biopsy where we get that information from one specific metastatic deposit.
Dr. Brown, how are you tailoring next-generation sequencing to specific patients? What are some of the characteristics that you're using to make the selection, and how can this tailored approach really translate to the community setting?
So it's an excellent question. I think Dr. Hussain just mentioned some of the conditions with lung cancer where, you know, tissue is still the gold standard, but there are times when it's insufficient and we may have to choose an alternate method like liquid biopsy when that's not available. And then also in regards to, well, if like liquid biopsy is performed first and it has a strong positive predictive value, but what do you do when it's negative to make sure that you interrogate the tissue to the full advantage? And I think those are probably the most common instances with lung cancer. Other things that are looked at, there are a lot of NGS tests on the market that are targeted for lung cancer, and all of them, although we kind of fall under the bucket or under the diagnostic umbrella of non-small cell lung cancer, but we often see very different genetic or genomic alterations in squamous cell or small cell compared to non-small cell, you know, the bucket of non-small cell lung cancer, which primarily the majority of them are adenocarcinoma. So it's something that we continue to be on the lookout for, new alterations that are detected in squamous cell carcinomas. We see certain signatures that are associated with squamous cells carcinomas of smokers, which is a different genomic signature than what we see in squamous cell carcinomas of skin exposed areas, but they're more similar. A squamous cell carcinoma of the lung is more similar to a squamous cell of the skin or head and neck than it is to an adenocarcinoma of the lung. And so we want to make sure that when we design and develop our NGS profiles, that we're taking all of those things into account, because a diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer is not always adenocarcinoma. And we want to make sure that those patients that are not adenocarcinoma still get the appropriate workup that they need and the relevant genes that are affected so that they can get enrolled in a clinical trial or get an appropriate therapy. Because we do not treat squamous cell carcinomas of the lung the same way we treat adenocarcinomas of the lung. So that's another way that we can specify it. Probably the last category that I tend to see, we often get what are thought to be primary lung carcinomas that actually are metastatic lesions from other locations. And so another thing that we often see when we see certain characteristics that don't really fit the profile, a lot of those certain genes, that I can think of a specific case that I saw recently where the only significant mutation was a RET mutation, and it was defined as a poorly differentiated lung cancer, and it turned out that it was actually a metastatic thyroid cancer, and the RET was almost pathognomonic for that type, or the location within the RET protein was almost pathognomonic for a thyroid cancer, and not something that was seen very often in a lung cancer. So I think remaining open-minded and being able to use all of your medical knowledge and molecular knowledge in a very patient-centered way can help make sure that you're tailoring it to the patient's needs.
Dr. Hussain, could you highlight some of the current barriers that need to be overcome with regard to biomarker testing in lung cancer? What technologies are really emerging to attempt to overcome some of these barriers?
So this is a very important question, largely because some of these barriers are structural in the context of the fact that as we expand the number of biomarkers that are needed in lung cancer, we need to have adequate tissue to survey these markers. And so really understanding the fact that getting as much tissue from a biopsy is really critical. And whether that be through core biopsies, as well as biopsies obtained through lymph node sampling, really has to be prioritized to obtain an adequate amount of sample. Another major barrier is the time to test result. And as mentioned earlier, because these biomarkers are needed prior to the initiation of therapy, it really is critical to get these results back in a quick and efficient manner. Furthermore, the reporting of the information in ways that don't get missed in busy offices and clinics is really critical. Liquid biopsy has the important benefit of a fast turnaround time, largely because the tissue does not need to be accessioned from pathology. Furthermore, to improve sensitivity for fusions and develop standards for copy number gain or amplification events is an unmet need. And we do need additional tools to standardize those criteria and make sure that for fusion events that there are additional strategies to make sure that those are detected with sufficient yield.
And Dr. Brown, on that note, fusions are playing a more significant role in diagnosis and treatment selection for patients with lung cancer. So how is that technology really evolving to detect these critical gene fusions?
The ability to detect the fusion events or gene rearrangements or translocations, however you want to describe those, but the ability to detect those by NGS through usually an RNA assay is critical. So it allows us, we talk about the comparison methods of how we've previously done them by FISH. For each FISH probe that we would be looking for, that we could potentially look for, we need a separate slide cut section of the tissue. And so if you're looking for 10 or more, you're talking about 10 or more slides. And so as we develop, you know, or discover more and more fusions that could potentially impact a patient, that we're talking about more and more tissue. So the only way for us to really be able to detect a wide number of fusions is through an RNA fusion assay. There are other benefits of doing it by NGS compared to alternate methods. And one of those is what we call agnostic to partner. So a lot of the FISH probes, you have to know both partners of the fusion or the translocation to be able to detect it. You can design what we call break apart probes, where any fusion will cause, you know, that probe to be separated, but they won't tell you exactly what partner it is. And sometimes the partner, the gene partner, is has important prognostic significance. And so those are things that we can do much more easily by RNA fusion profiles. And the other things that people don't really take into consideration is there are resistance mutations that make the drug that we would use to target the fusions ineffective. And so with some RNA-based test, or if you're doing both DNA and RNA by NGS, you can detect the fusion along with the significant resistance alterations that will indicate, well, yes, this patient has an ALK or a ROS fusion, but don't treat them with that because they also have the ALK or ROS resistance mutation. And so those things you would not ever be able to detect by FISH. We're also finding the more fusion assays we perform, that there's a lot more cryptic, what we call cryptic fusions, that would not be able to be detected by FISH at all because they're too small. So NGS fusion, because we are sequencing every single nucleotide and we're able to map that to the human genome, we know how big, let's say if a part of it's deleted in the middle, or if the fusion is only like, what, you know, 10,000 nucleotides apart, we would be able to detect that. But FISH probes are what we call megabases. So there's millions of base pairs. And so a change has to be of significant size for it to be detected. So these internal rearrangements cannot, like something as small as MET exon 14 deletion or MET a skipping alteration could not be detected by FISH, can only be detected by NGS. So that's a lot of the ways I think that these are being discovered. But also, you know, the more we test, you know, the more we find. So there's a lot of new fusions, new genes, for example, maybe not specific to lung, but the new WHO Blue Book for CNS tumors comes out this month. And what we previously thought was a RELA fusion, ependymoma, it turns out the RELA gene is not the gene of interest. It was the partner gene all along. And so a lot of these ability, you know, have we just been doing this by FISH, we might have missed, those cases would have been missed by FISH. But because NGS is able to sequence both partners, that's how that was discovered.
To both of you, what is next for biomarker identification? What are you really keeping your eye on that could have clinical implications for practicing oncologists?
In answer to this question, actually, I would say that there are many opportunities for improvements in biomarker identification on the horizon. I think we have a number of indications that are being explored, one being minimal residual disease, where after surgery, the ability to look at a liquid biopsy to identify which patients may be best candidates for adjuvant therapy or not is an area of exploration forward. Recurrence monitoring is a key component where there are trials looking at serial testing to identify how the ability to track cancer over times may correlate with PFS and OS. Also in that tracking process, how qualitatively the cancer can change may be an important area for further growth and drug discovery. Another area of growth and opportunity is really understanding how co-alterations with certain genes can predict outcomes. We now know that with KRAS mutated patients, the co-association of P53 or STK11 or KEAP1 may have important implications for prognosis and perhaps with therapy. For EGFR mutations, co-occurring alterations may also be important. And then another unmet need is we need better biomarkers for immune therapy and ways to expand the biomarker identification to include genomic and in composite biomarkers in that space is needed. An example being tumor mutation burden, TMB. I think we still have some additional opportunities to really interrogate that as a biomarker for immune therapy.
I love what Dr. Hussain said about composite mutations and the ability to look at how these multiple positive biomarkers might impact each other. Particularly, we know in certain treatment situations where a co-mutation of multiple things impacts whether or not the therapy for one specific target may be effective. And also the mention of tumor mutation burden, I always think about the things in addition to the single, you know, we always want to discover the new single gene that has a significant impact, either prognosis or survival, or we'll have a potential targeted therapy, but we're starting to learn more about what, you know, the global impact or landscape of a particular cancer, how it plays a role. So tumor mutation burden, we've discovered in recent years, is an alternative biomarker for immunotherapy, in addition to what we, you know, previously discovered PD-L1 by IHC, which was the companion diagnostic for those drugs. And we're also MSI, which can be performed by a variety of methods, but is becoming more and more common to be performed in an NGS profile along with tumor mutation burden. So those types of global conditions of the cancer play an impact, but additional things on the horizon, we're looking at what's called the methylome. So the overall methylation status among multiple, what we call CpG islands. So meaning there's multiple genes in the tumor genome that are silenced. And we recognize that there's less than 1,000 genes that actually play a role in cancer. But things like global methylation status, it stands to reason that some of those really important genes will be affected by that. And we're starting to see more and more of those things becoming standard. They're starting to appear in the WHO guidelines for that pathologists use, what we call the blue books when we make our diagnoses. It's becoming part of the diagnostic criteria for some diseases, as well as the staging and grading of these particular diseases. So other, what we call the epigenetic markers, like for ovarian cancer, what we call, a genomic instability score or, you know, their HRD status. And so a lot more than just, you know, single gene, a one-to-one relationship with treatment, but starting to look as a genomic gestalt approach to tumors going forward. And that's going to require a lot more next generation sequencing. It won't be things that we can do with a single gene test.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Enclave on Air, sponsored by NeoGenomics. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives in cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at Enclave SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave on Air.